1, 2, 3, 1.
My buddy shunned me since I turned to Jesus. They say I'm missing a whole world of fun, but I still love them and I sing with pride. I like the Christian life. I won't lose a friend by heeding God's call. Or what is a friend who'd want you to fall? Despise. I like the Christian life.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Michael Marinacci. We're going to be discussing his new book, California Jesus. Michael, it's great having you on the show.
Well, it's good being on the show, Robert. Thank you.
And I'm also joined here with Pill Eater and J.J. Michaels.
Hey there. Hey, guys.
What's up?
And you've had a number of different books about California, and you had one a while back called Weird California, but this one, California Jesus, focuses mainly on Christian cults.
Well, I don't know if I'd use the word cult, sects, denominations, evangelists, and spiritual groups that came out of or settled in the state of California over its history. I think one or two of the groups I cover would be called cults, and that they were definitely destructive and led by some pretty scary people, but most of what I've really covered in there in California Jesus is fairly straightforward, if eccentric and unusual, figures and their followers. So, yeah, Weird California, I co-wrote with Joe Osterley and Greg Bishop, and that covered more just the strange phenomenon and unusual places in the state, whereas this is really focusing on sort of religious sociology and a spiritual landscape. It was really part of a large project I've been working on for many years when I wanted to do a massive book about the everything that had gone on in California spiritually and religiously going back to Spanish colonial days. But it just got to be too much, and finally my then-girlfriend, who was also a writer, suggested, why don't you just start out with the Christian groups? And that's what I did, and Ronin Publishing put it into print, and here we are.
So you talk about the Christian sects. Do you also get into the sort of different New Age cults, like Heaven's Gate? I know some of they kind of borrow off of Christian theology, but they're not really Christianity.
Really, living in the Western world, you kind of soak in Christian theology and mythos and ethics, and so naturally they're all going to borrow from it. I really concentrated on groups that were explicitly Christian, meaning, by my definition, you could have the leaders or the people in them recite the Nicene Creed and pretty much believe it with their hearts and their minds. I think once you get off of that rather fairly universal standard of what a Christian believer is, then you get into things that are a bit different. I'm planning to write other books, and certainly groups like Heaven's Gate and some of the more notorious organizations that came out of here, like People's Temple and whatnot, will be covered. But I have tended, in California Jesus, and will in later books, to focus on the less well-known and less written about individuals and groups that were out there.
Which of these groups is the earliest one you go over? Was this primarily in the mid-19th century? I think you did talk about an evangelical cult in L.A.
Yeah, that was the New Testament church. That was started by a Scottish immigrant named William Monet. He started out in Mexico and had been a big evangelical pastor in the early years of the Mexican Republic and had done a lot of debates and horn-locking with Catholic padres and theologians there, and then migrated up to the Pueblo de Los Angeles when it was still part of Mexican territory and sort of continued his act up there. When it became American territory after the Mexican War, he founded his own evangelical church called the New Testament Church. It never got to be more than about a dozen members, but then that was a lot of people for a town that at the time had only about 3,000 residents in it, and wrote what is the first, and published what is believed to be the first English language book published in Los Angeles. I believe it was in 1853, called The Reform of the New Testament. He was a wild character. He once had himself buried alive to test his faith. He was a self-proclaimed doctor who had claimed to have treated several thousand people. Was a geographer. He put this together, this amazing collection of hand-drawn maps that were destroyed during the Mexican and American War, and also had some very strange scientific and geographic theories as well, and he ended up building this very peculiar octagonal-shaped building near what's present-day San Gabriel, which was the Monean Institute, where he sort of held forth with his religious and secular teachings, and really was the first of his kind. He was the first California cultist, essentially, the first person to really come in and establish an essentially new sect or denomination. Everybody in his wake, I think, owes a little bit to him for really breaking the ground back when Los Angeles was still Mexican and was still mostly Spanish-speaking.
You made the point that Los Angeles was the center of Pentecostalism. There's kind of a perception that it primarily came out of the South.
Well, I think it's because it really... Really, in the United States, we really associate religious fervor of any kind with Dixie because of the peculiar history and character and culture of the South. But Pentecostalism came out of Los Angeles. The first manifestations of it were actually in the Midwest under Charles Parham's study group. But then African-American pastor who was originally from Texas named William Seymour set up in downtown L.A. and really started as an organized movement when you would have these flocks of people coming first to a home on Bonnie Bray Avenue in downtown L.A. and then to a church he set up. And this was about early 1906. We're having the first real demonstrations of what now we call Pentecostalism, which is the very emotive style of worship, the speaking in tongues, the dancing, the yelling and noise. And then many of the followers started falling down and flailing around on the ground, and that's where they got the term holy roller from. It really gained traction in the wake of the San Francisco earthquake in April of that year, because people said, oh, maybe something is going on. Maybe we are in the last days. And, you know, down the state now in L.A., they're having this incredible revival like nothing we've ever seen before. Maybe there is something to that. And so missionaries with this message and sort of advocating this very wild style of worship went all over the world. And it is believed today that there may be as many as 500 million Pentecostal Christians. That's something like one in four Christian believers on earth may be involved with the movement somehow. It just caught fire. And it all really started in downtown L.A., among the small African-American community there, and then it spread to other ethnic groups. And that was one of the things that really made it very controversial at the time, was you had a black leader of this very powerful religious movement, and you had black and white and Latino and Asian men and women mixing together and hugging and doing the kiss and rolling together on the floor, and, whoa, miscegenation, we can't have that now, can we? So was really brought about a lot of very racist fears, but it survived that, and it became... It took on such a huge life of its own, and I get into the in California Jesus. I get into the story of William Seymour and what's called the Azusa Street movement and Azusa Street Pentecostalism in more detail.
Would you say that California is unique in that it attracted and created so many of these small splinter religious Christian sects?
They've always been around. I mean, there has never really, I always like to say that the one time that what we call the Christian church was united was at Pentecost. And then once the apostles and the hundreds started going off in their own direction to evangelize the world, all the differences of theology and practice and doctrine and what have you started creeping in. And I think only the Nicene Council and the Assembly of the Holy Bible in the 4th century were able to get some relative kind of uniformity. California is special in that, I think, because of its geography, it's as far as you can go in what we call the Western world, as far west. And there's always been a thing, not just in Western history, but I think in human history, of heading west for freedom. Starting in Central Asia, and then you can kind of watch the whole path of progression of civilization and of creativity, and also of capital, of artistic movements, whatever, heading from the Middle East to the Eastern Mediterranean, to Central Europe, to Western Europe, the UK, the Eastern the seaboard of the U.S., and then all the way out to the Golden State. And it's always been a place, at least as far back as the Gold Rush, where people chased dreams here, whether they were to make a whole lot of money overnight, or to reinvent themselves, or to do something really crazily creative. I think it really comes with the history and culture and the whole kind of spirit of the place. And as I mentioned in the introduction to California Jesus, there's been a lot of studying of your more quintessentially Californian cults and religious sects, which would be, you know, the Theosophical movements and the Eastern groups that came over here from Asia, and the neo-pagans, and then the real scary ones like the Manson family and People's Temple and whatnot, but not very much of the very distinctly distinct Christian heritage that we have here, as far as this kind of creativity with doctrine, with practice, with theology, with culture, is just as much there as it is in any of the other less Orthodox faith traditions that have kind of flourished in the Golden State.
You have all these televangelists who are famous for making a fortune from their followers. Did that also get its start in California?
Well, yeah, I know that really, in many ways, the first electronic evangelist was Amy Semple McPherson. She was one of the first Christian evangelists to really take advantage of radio, which was a very new thing in the 1920s when she got going. And then later on, you had Herbert W. Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God really pioneering international radio stations, and Radio Luxembourg, which was, because it was out at sea, was not regulated by any government. And then later on, a TV show that was broadcast all over the world. And finally, by the 1970s, you had somebody who also would like Armstrong was based in Pasadena, and that was the great Gene Scott. kind of not only having this international televangelist empire that he'd really created by doing an end run around the FCC and just buying up time on cable networks, but really it became this almost kind of performance art he would do, where he was just so... Well, he was basically what Liberace was to classical music. Gene Scott was to evangelical Christianity. He was so over the top, so flamboyant, so wild that it became this kind of object of fascination for people who weren't believers at all. And he was obviously a very bright man, very well educated, but an entertainer too. And that feeds in, I think, very much to L.A. especially, but I think California as a whole is the center of the entertainment industry, and certainly, you know, circling back to Sister Amy, she was very much influenced by early Hollywood in setting these huge, crazy spectacles she would have at the Four Square Church of recreating the Red Sea with actual seawater in the church and having some mechanism where she would part it, and the people clothed as Israelites would be running through it, and then riding a motorcycle around on stage dressed as a policewoman. Again, the flamboyance that I think kind of flowed out of and also in a turn influenced Hollywood and our various sectors of entertainment industry was a very Californian thing.
Yeah, I think one of the most morose topics that you cover in the book is the Children of God cult, which connected Joaquin and River Phoenix. If you could talk about the Children of God, that would be a very interesting topic.
Okay. Well, for those of the listeners who aren't familiar with the Children of God, they were really the foremost and most notorious of what are often referred to as the Jesus people or the Christian hippie movement of the late 60s and well into the 70s, that really did a lot of evangelical work among the youth counterculture of the time and sort of took on a lot of the appearances and uses and sort of informality of the hippie movement, but also was fairly evangelical and fairly, you know, straightforward Bible-based Christian. It was not very mystical or very liberal, which is paradoxically what you would expect of a counterculture. Now, the Children of God, their particular thing was they were led by a man named David Berg, who had been raised as an evangelist and spent many years sort of unsuccessfully pursuing that career and had worked at evangelical radio and TV for a while. He, around the time he was 50, he started ministering to runaways and hippies and street kids in Southern California and became very apocalyptic. He was very, very new left. He was saying, you know, the system is corrupt. We have to have a revolution, but it's got to be a revolution for Christ. It's got to be a spiritual revolution. And started setting up communes that were based around his teachings. Well, around the mid-70s, he came up with this novel idea on how to effectively bring more people into the church, which was by something he called flirty fishing. And that was to have the young women and some of the young men go out and find lost sheep of the opposite sex and literally seduce them into the kingdom, use themselves basically as what he called heaven's harlots, using their sexuality to bring people in. And this became, even in the swinging 70s, this was very, very controversial. They were really considered before People's Temple popped up on the map in a big way. They were considered, along with the Moonies, like public enemy number one among cults, partly because of this practice. And they largely went underground by the end of the 70s. They continued it, but they really became much more sub rosa You mentioned the Phoenix Brothers. They were both born and raised in the Children of God. I believe that River Phoenix once said that he had lost his virginity at the age of four. One really, really bad thing about the children, the former Children of God, which were also called the Family, was they promoted childhood sexuality and sexual behavior among kids. They were not really, not molestation, but they were most definitely promoting a kind of erotic behavior among children that I think today would get you landed in the Who's Gal real quickly. And even back then, I think they had to be a little more, even at that time, more innocent time, they were being fairly discreet about it. But it's been quite well documented. Eventually, Bird died. His daughter took over the operation. Or actually, not his daughter, I'm sorry. His young wife took over the operation and still runs it. I believe she's about 70 right now. And they say that they've jettisoned most of their teachings, his teachings in that way. They stopped doing flirty fishing in the late 80s because of AIDS. But a lot of ex-members of the group say that on the down low, they're still saying and doing some pretty suspect things having to do with keeping Berg's whole sort of erotic evangelical attitude going in their ranks. I haven't, I'm not really close enough to any currently involved. I've seen a lot of documents by ex-members, so I couldn't really tell you, but I can say that their story at the height of their notoriety, which I cover in California Jesus, is pretty extreme, is pretty scary. And they really, about 10 years ago, they ended up in the headlines again because this adoptive son of the leader, who had been raised in this from the beginning and had been basically molested by his female nannies, ended up as an adult going out and murdering one of them and then killing himself and leaving this video testimony behind about what he'd gone through and what he'd seen all these other kids raised in the group go through. So that's the Children of God in California Jesus, and I cover them at length.
Do you go into religious sects that use drug use, like count whether it's cannabis, LSD, or peyote?
Well, I don't. I didn't find any specifically Christian groups that do that. That's really something. And again, this is one of the many things I've studied. Has been groups that use entheogens for as sacraments. And I do have another book that I'm working on right now that covers that. In California Jesus, I think the only example of something like that I would think of would be, or even vaguely related to that, would be R.L. Hymers and the Fundamentalist Army. Back when, made themselves very notorious during the release of the movie The Last Temptation of Christ by having these very over-the-top protests about it that many people took as being openly anti-Semitic. Earlier in his career, Hymers had raised a lot of eyebrows when he kind of went from one theology to another, and when he was in a more kind of liberal evangelical one, he was raising some eyebrows in that world by saying, hey, it's okay to drink in moderation. If you're stressed out, need to relax, whatever, this is all right. He said something like, drink like Jesus, not like erring Noah. You probably, maybe the story of the Old Testament where Noah gets drunk and inadvertently exposes himself to his three sons, and Ham, who's the kind of unlucky one, is, you know, who sees him in the state, is cursed. And but that's the only substance use or abuse I think I really cover in there. That's really a fascinating subject in itself that I will be writing about in another book soon. And that one will go beyond California.
You talk about a Joseph Jeffers of the Kingdom of Yahweh, and
yes,
you were saying earlier that he actually fused the sort of New Age stuff, like a belief in UFOs, into Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's my, in many ways, my favorite subject in the book. This is a man who was active for, had a 70-year-long career, was just going to the very end when he died at 89, went through all sorts of strange theological changes, and he started out as a very hard-shell Baptist preacher. And then while he was doing these Baptist revivals, he actually touched off a full-scale, genuine shooting religious war in the state of Arkansas in the early 1930s. And I talk about the Jonesboro War in there, which was really quite ugly and has not really been heard of very much outside of the state of Arkansas. Then he got into what was called sacred name theology, and that's a sort of theological tendency within what we call Adventist Christianity, where you don't use the words God or Jesus to address the Father and Son, because those are believed to be pagan terms and very and incorrect. But you use the Hebraic terms or Aramaic, which are Yahweh and Yahshua. When he was doing that, he settled in Los Angeles and really had his California presence. He was a notorious figure in L.A., had a huge meeting hall downtown, a radio show, got in trouble with the federal government because he was a fascist sympathizer, was very tight with the Silver Shirts, who were the big West Coast fascist group in the 30s. Got embroiled in a big scandal having to do with his and his wife's sexual strangeness, which I get into in California Jesus. And by the 1940s, he was really in some very odd territory where he was claiming that he was the son of Yahweh, that Yahweh was actually this space being living out in the constellation of Orion, who had stored billions and billions of dollars of American money for him to use when he passes on and start his kingdom. And he was a survivalist. He was trying to get his followers to he got money from his followers to set up a survival camp out near Palm Springs, because he was convinced that after Hiroshima and Nagasaki there'd be a all-out nuclear war and they'd be the only survivors.
Was he affiliated with the Seventh-day Adventist Church? Because I know they have there's an apocalyptic element to that.
Yeah, well, he picked up this. I don't know if he actually. I think he may have gone straight into Sacred Name, which is a subgroup of Adventism, from Southern Baptism. He didn't really spend any time in Orthodox Adventism, unlike somebody like Herbert Armstrong, who did. Herbert Armstrong went from Baptism to more or less Orthodox Seventh-day Adventism to Radical Adventism and then to his own odd kind of theology where he denied the Trinity. So that was a pagan concept, and there's only God and his son Jesus, and the Holy Spirit is the action of them and not a person. And also got very, very heavily and was very influential in promulgating what's called Anglo-Israelism, which is the belief that the lost tribes of Israel migrated in ancient times to Western Europe, or more specifically the British Isles, and are now basically the descendants of peoples of Western Europe.
Is a Reverend Wesley Swift and his Christian Identity Movement, is that an offshoot of Anglo-Israelism?
Absolutely, and they were a particularly radical one in that, whereas you have somebody like Herbert Armstrong, who is Anglo-Israelite, or Gene Scott, who was also one, saying, yes, the white race, we're the lost tribes, but this means we have to be really righteous and we have to be really good to our cousins, the Jews, the tribe of Judah, and to the people who are not of this blood. We have to be a shining light into the world. Swift and the Church of Jesus Christ Christian took it a bit further, and they said, that their whole theology, which was based on things that go back all the way back to Gnostic teachings, was that the Jews were not really the children of Israel at all. They were Canaanite usurpers. And the Canaanites had, because per their name, were the descendants of Cain, the bad boy in the original family, who himself was conceived not by Adam but by Eve and either Satan or some kind of demonic entity. So they promulgated this thing that the Jews, what we call the Jews today, were not only not Israelites, but they had this demon seed in their root and were just evil and scheming, and they deprived white Christians of their birthright, and it was his responsibility or his mission to bring this in. Another thing they said was, if you weren't of European descent, well, these were the people who were descendants of what is called in Genesis the beasts of the field, which were these proto-humans that preceded Adam and Eve, that were looked like humans but weren't really with them. So it was this very racist and anti-Semitic doctrine that he'd taken Anglo-Israelism and really kind of weaponized it for this very ugly teaching, and had a lot of influence in certain areas. In fact, he was, if you've ever heard of the Aryan Nations and that whole crew that were up in the Idaho Panhandle for many years, well, they were directly the direct descendants and heirs of his operation, and pretty much believed the same thing. And they took it to step further in that they had actual terrorists and criminals connected with them, acting on these beliefs and doing killings and bank robberies and all sorts of nasty stuff in the 1980s, and still to a certain extent they're out there. They're just not as active as they were 30 years ago.
One thing I wanted to cover asking you was, you mentioned Gene Scott and the his sort of holy roller style, where he was asking people for money and then showing his mansions and whatnot to people. A precursor to that that I know you talk about in the book is Thomas and B.B. Patton, if you could talk about that.
Oh, yes. See, Thomas and B.B. That is one of these stories that I discuss in California Jesus that just... they got their 15 minutes of fame in the 1950s, and then everybody forgot about it. But it is so fascinating because in many ways they were the first really greedy, really big-time evangelical, I'll use the word, swindlers. They were based in Oakland and sort of took over after Amy Semple McPherson died. She also died in Oakland in the 1940s. They sort of took over for her as really the big Pentecostal movement in California and much of the U.S., but their whole thing was, Thomas, who was the husband of the two, it was a husband and wife, was just this master at wheedling the congregation out of money. He would spend like half of the service with the collections, browbeating and bullying people and calling them cheapskates and using every abusive trick you could in the book you could think of to basically get money from these working class Oaklanders. I believe he made, and this is 1940s and early 50s dollars, they know that at one point he had over $1 million in his personal account, and they believe there was probably several million that he'd mulcted both his followers and various financial institutions for. He was very, very good at scamming not only these Dust Bowl refugees, but these very respectable Bay Area banks for money, for unsecured loans and all sorts of things. To my knowledge, there was nothing like that before in American history, where the greed was at that level and was that blatant. And I think you really had to wait until the 1980s with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker or people like that before you saw it again.
Are they the one who found the Crystal Cathedral in Orange County?
No, that was a little different. That was a somewhat different thing. That was Robert Schuller, and Schuller was much more low key. And then I believe right now the Roman Catholic Church has that building. It has a kind of an odd history. But it's funny because Patton University, which was originally their little mail order and diploma mill, is now this very respected evangelical Christian university in private in Oakland. It's been around for many years. In fact, in 2008, Senator Ted Kennedy spoke there for a big crowd supporting then Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign. I remember scanning news reports at the time and said, is anybody going to do any research about the history of the Pattons? Are they going to do anything? And no, none of this ever came out. It was so well buried, and I think part of the reason it was well buried was because after C. Thomas was nailed by the law for this and had to go to had to be a guest of the state of California for a few years, his wife Beebe really instituted a cleanup and really got busy on the public relations and things like that, and really kind of turned things around. And by the time she passed on, and I believe she lived into her 90s, this stuff had all been forgotten. She'd just been thought of as this very, it's rather progressive and very, very respected religious leader in the East Bay. And everybody seemed to have forgotten about how they started out, which was just as complete grifters.
Do you go into the whole prosperity doctrine, where a lot of these preachers, they say that if you follow the teachings of this church, that you'll become wealthy?
Well, I would say not specifically, but I would say somebody who was sort of an early pioneer of that theology or teaching or whatever would have been King Louis Narcisse, also a good Oaklander. He was an African-American evangelist and singer who had the Kingdom Spiritual Temple in Oakland for many, many years. He'd have some teachings that kind of implied, yes, if you went along with this positive attitude and donated money to him and, you know, kept your nose clean and didn't go to the Emeryville gambling houses or the San Francisco nightclubs, it would be reflected in your, not only your spiritual, but your material prosperity. He once said something, he would bless money. He would say a blessed nickel will take you farther than a $100 bill that has sin all over it. He was very much, and he used to say, emphasize, he says, well, I have to attract people this way because spiritual people you win with spiritual things, and there's carnal people out there too, and you've got to use a carnal approach to get at them. So I see in California Jesus, I discuss his story of he was also had himself crowned king. He went beyond being a spiritual leader into his own sort of self-styled monarchy, which was fascinating how he set that up. And I discuss him, and he's another Oaklander who's just kind of been until California Jesus really got largely thrown into the memory hole. He was hugely influential in the 1960s around the area, but has largely been forgotten.
I was going to ask, I know on your blog you cover Jack T. Chick and his comic book ministries. Do you cover that at all in California Jesus at all? And would you like to
talk about that? Oh, absolutely I did. Yeah, it is very hard to talk about California-based or originated Christian ministry or apologetics and not deal with the late, great Mr. Chick and his 800 million tracts. That is an actual number, an estimate of how many have been printed and distributed over the last 55, 60 years, since he got going. It's estimated that his influence on the Christian world, as far as writing, as far as text, is second only to the Holy Bible itself. That is the level that he operated at. And I get into his story. I get into the controversies about about the comic books, the little booklets he handed out. One thing that I pointed out, which hardly anybody, when I did research on them, nobody else seemed to want to mention this. I said, I think he always used to say he got the idea for these little teeny comic books with these extremely ultra fundamentalist evangelist message in them from Chinese communists who would use these to teach, illiterate or barely literate peasants. They'd print these things with Maoist doctrines and then have them spread all over the country. I always thought he was also influenced by what are called Tijuana Bibles, which back in the bad old days were these scurrilous little comic books that would be parodies of either existing comic strips like Blondie or Popeye or whatever, or would have caricatures of famous movie stars of the time like Mae West or Cary Grant or whatnot, but they'd be triple X rated pornographic and really, really crude. And I am sure that these things very ironically influenced what has become the greatest written form of Christian evangelism in history. Was born on the one hand out of communist doctrine, on the other hand out of this real slimy pornography that used to be very common among preteen boys back before the internet and whatnot. So yeah, he's a very interesting guy. Very strange people who've attached themselves to his ministry over the years, and I discuss that in California Jesus as well. Some very peculiar doctrines and things that he's maintained. But the book came out right before he passed on, so it's a little dated that way. But I do really get down his biography, and really, I think it's in many ways probably the most. Probably the most information-packed account of the Jack T. Chick ministry and publishing and whatever that I've seen yet in California Jesus.
Speaking of Christianity and all this interesting influences to pornography and communism, such that we're talking about science fiction, are you aware of a science fiction author by the name of Gene Wolfe?
Oh, yes.
What do you think about The Book of the New Sun, and if there's any commentary on that? Because I think of that as a very esoteric Christian work of Christianity within science fiction, and it's very strange because it's not well known, but it has this weird cult following about it because it's kind of like a Beowulf of the future, but as well has a hardcore Christian message in it, and as well an interesting work of, I guess you want to call it esoteric meme magic or something like that.
Well, I'm not. I've heard of him. I've heard of his works. I haven't read any of them. I don't have a real intimate familiarity with them, so I really can't comment on that. I can say that in California Jesus, I have gone a little bit over into some of the more esoteric or mystical groups. Certainly, somebody like Jeffers, because of his mixing of baptism with fringe Adventism, with this almost UFO and New Age theology and mythos and involving the lost continents of Atlantis and Lemuria and things like that, gets into that. But Wolfe, really, I see that as a literary figure rather than an evangelist or an organized movement. Although the cult that you have around his work that you have mentioned is intriguing. Most definitely.
I'll give some reference on it because I've looked through it. Well, his most known book, his breakthrough book, was The Shadow of the Torturer, which is, mm-hmm. It's a series of four books called the Book of the New Sun. It's one book, but was separated in four parts. It takes upon this narrative a million years in the future when Earth is decayed, and it's called the Uth, and it's in this weird Beowulf language. What's interesting about it is that it has a huge rereadable value to the book. You read it, mm-hmm. and it sounds like a Baroque fantasy. Read it again, yeah. It's sinister, and you look behind the text, it's actually, the towers are spaceships, the ogres are not green ogres, they're mutants, and the character Severian, who's this super, I guess you want to say, god emperor of the future, makes sure that, you know, he's unreliable. The book is also famous is because Wolf also introduces old Latin and strange terms and puts them again to mean something else of an undescribable future. But what makes the book very interesting, that a lot of people are looking into, is that it's theological. In fact, there's the four books in the series are hierarchical. It starts with The Shadow of the Torturer, The Claw of the Conciliator, The Sword of the Lictor, and the Castle of the Autarch. But it's from grade, starting from you're a torturer to an autarch. But before he, like a Jesus figure, recreates the world and saves the earth. But it has this very much theories from Nick Land, neo-reactionaryism, to Christian futurism, and this kind of cult based around, it's transhumanist in nature, but it's also very critical of liberal worlds. As one more thing to add in, that there's a group called the Asians that live up in North America, and they speak, and they're all like these weird ultra communist people that, and the Severian is comes from the South, where like this super race of these Asian looking exaltants, and it's very interesting, and it drinks a very painted figure, because you're talking about all this. It just reminds me of that work of Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun.
Really, the mythos, the Christian mythos, is funny. Just like every generation gets something new out of it and puts a new spin on it, or you have these works that kind of build on that and take it somewhere else. I saw a very funny meme the other day, which was something. It showed the Torah, the Bible, and the Quran, and it said this is the desert trilogy, and then the number one is the Torah is the rise of the Jews, and the number two is the return of the Jew, and number three is for the Quran is Muhammad strikes back, and then at the bottom they have a copy of the Book of the Mormon, and it says fan fiction.
It is like the golden tablets, and it really is. Yeah, it kind of is. It's like the extra book. I would say that.
While we're on the subject, I mentioned the Mormons. One thing I mentioned in California Jesus is the little known story of what was called the Mormon Battalion, which was the only U.S. military unit ever segregated by religion. During the Mexican-American War, it was a group of early Mormons who had volunteered to fight with the U.S. Against Mexico in the Mexican-American War. And when it was mostly over, a lot of them resettled in what's now called San Bernardino and set up a religious community there, and were quite successful for a while. And it was actually a fairly tolerant place. There were a lot of non-Mormons that lived around them, and they were racially integrated, and which was very unusual for the pre-Civil War period. It broke apart because they started, as more people came in, they started having more and more disputes with the non-Mormons over property and business. And then in 1857, when Utah was threatened by the U.S. government because of polygamy and a few other issues, Brigham Young called them all back and said, "You've got to come back to you've got to come back to Deseret and defend it, you know, defend the land against in case we have to fight for it." And that's something that very few people around the whole Inland Empire area know, that this was, in many ways, San Bernardino started out, along with having the mission, as a Mormon colony founded by this funny little volunteer battalion of Mormons vets from the Mexican-American War.
Was there another incident you were saying that happened during the Civil War when there was some kind of a splinter group? I forget. Was it Mormons who wanted to seize California as their own country?
Part of the plan of some of them. I know that Sam Brannan, who is one of the great early figures of American San Francisco, was a Mormon. And the story that I heard is they'd come, and right after the war, they'd come into the San Francisco to try to settle it as sort of the western extension of their of their own colony, their own settlement, but found out that it had already been occupied by American troops and commercial interests, and so kind of begrudgingly just settled there. And Brannan, of course, was the famous man who, after there was the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill, he got a glass jar of it and started running up and down the streets of San Francisco saying, "Gold, gold on the American River," and that was what kicked off the great 1849 gold rush. But yeah, there was this plan among many people in the LDS to extend their a whole series of colonies from the Salt Lake all the way through the U.S. out to California and have this kind of like long supply chain, and it never really took off. Partly because the gold rush was the main reason. There was just too much. They couldn't control California, the newly American California anymore. That the old saying, the world rushed in. It wasn't just thousands and thousands of Americans suddenly pouring in. It was thousands of men from all over the world with gold fever.
You talk about the Metropolitan Community Church for Gays. This was founded by a reverend who was thrown out of the Pentecostal church.
Yes, Troy Perry, who is still with us, really interesting guy. His whole story, he was from the Florida Panhandle, and like many other people I'm discussing here, had started out as a Baptist and then became a Pentecostal preacher. And like many men and women in the pre-Stonewall days, struggled very mightily with their own feelings of homosexuality, and he finally came out of the closet and got thrown out of the church, although he was a very skilled preacher, and one thing led to another. He was in the Army for a while, and he started, I believe, 1968, the Metropolitan Community Church, which may have had the first open service that was openly made by and for gays and lesbians in probably 1,500 years in the Christian church. And that's another group that really took off, partly because of his efforts. He is a very good organizer and speaker and theologian, and partly because I think once you have the sexual revolution and you get Stonewall and all that happening, once people started coming out of the closet and saying, "Hey, I'm gay, I'm lesbian, I'm bisexual, I'm transsexual, whatever," they didn't want to give up their Christian beliefs. They really wanted to be part of that community and have that, you know, that feeling that they were following Christ. And well, the Metropolitan, the MCC, was there for them. And they did a lot of very good pastoral work over the years too, particularly during the depths of the AIDS crisis in the mid and late 80s. So yeah, I discussed the MCC and Troy Perry quite extensively in California Jesus, including the fact that they lost something like 32 people in one night in what was called the Upstairs Bar Fire in New Orleans, Louisiana. They were having a post-gay pride beer bash there and a little sort of church social, and somebody lit the building on fire, and it was like the deadliest conflagration in the city's history, and the papers just treated them as a joke and made fun of them, and it just really enraged the reverend and his followers, and it became this big national thing of, hey, these are human beings too. Why are you, you know, why are they being treated this way? And there's, in the book, I reproduce a little a picture of a plaque that's been placed in the pavement outside of where the bar used to be, honoring the dead there of the Metropolitan Community Church. And I also have a little sort of appendage chapter on that where I discuss another very famous and hugely influential gay Californian Christian evangelist, and that would have been Lonnie Frisbee. The difference between, they both had very similar lives and backgrounds, lots of abuse in childhood, being raped as boys in childhood, really kind of reaching out to have spirit into spirituality to deal with their hurt and their problems. The difference is that Perry came out at a very young age, and Frisbee never really came out and ended up dying of AIDS. But he was one of the real spark plugs, if not the one, behind Calvary Church and then what's called now called the Vineyard Church movement. He was a hippie Christian, but had kind of taken it beyond that and had been this phenomenally talented and charismatic evangelist who led this double life where he was very actively pursuing gay sex and relationships on the down low, and unfortunately they ended up killing him. And there's a great documentary about Frisbee as well that was came out about 10, 12 years ago. Real interesting guy.
I'd like to know about, I've been waiting to ask you for an hour, the Universal Life Church and Reverend Kirby Hensley, the Modesto Messiah.
Well, I discussed them on my blog, which is called Califia's Children, but they're not in California Jesus because it is not technically a Christian church. There have been Christian groups that have been formed under the aegis of the ULC, but Kirby Hensley himself, again, started out as a Baptist and became Pentecostal, and it just seems to really be the pattern with these people that end up here. He eventually became more or less an atheist. He rewrote his own Bible and had some very strange beliefs. But his whole commitment was really to total sectarian diversity, where no matter what you believed or didn't believe, so long as the First Amendment guaranteed freedom of religion, and so long as churches could get tax exemptions, well, he was going to help you through the ULC. And there was recently one group that split off from the ULC in Florida that were explicitly Christian and really condemned Hensley as this faker, and you know, he was this atheist pretending to be a Christian, et cetera, et cetera. They haven't really taken fire much. They're around, but they're just kind of a small split off of the original ULC. But that's a whole fascinating story in itself, because it, you know, the whole story of the Universal Life Church just brings in all sorts of questions about, okay, what is an organized religion? What is belief? What is a church? And Hensley, I think, just forced a lot of these questions into both the culture and the legal system during the time he was around, and a lot of them still have not been resolved.
And in your book, you also get into Mel Gibson's church.
Yes, Holy Family Church up in Malibu. Yes, that's certainly one of the most well-known of all of the Christian groups that originated in California. They are a Catholic traditionalist, and they sort of exist in a gray area where they're not really recognized by the Roman Catholic Church. They've never really explicitly split from them. They're traditionalists. They have the Latin Mass. They have all the sort of pre-Vatican II doctrines and dogmas and whatnot. It was, I think, one of the reasons it exists at all was because Gibson made so much money off of the Passion of the Christ that a lot of it was through a foundation was plowed into constructing the building, which is very private and very secured up in the hills, and only has, and sort of a very small community of Catholic traditionalists that he's in touch with. That's another phenomenon that's fascinated me for a long time, is what are called the Old Catholic or the Independent Catholic Churches, which are groups that split off from Rome or from the canonical Orthodox groups or from Anglicanism, and have their own bishops and priests and churches, but kind of take it in these funny new directions, or where they can become either really, really, really traditional or completely avant-garde and esoteric. And I also discuss another group in there called the Mexican National Catholic Church, which were a split off from Rome, formed largely by the revolutionary Mexican government after the 1911-1916 revolution to sort of create this patriotic, Spanish-speaking, married priests national church that would be an alternative to Rome. And because so many of the revolutionaries were Freemasons and Freethinkers and secularists, they wanted to have this thing where they could try to drain support off of the Vatican. And I discuss how that went and how, ironically enough, it ended up that their strongest presence in the end was in California, not Mexico.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add about your book, California Jesus?
Well, it's published by the famous Ronan Publishing of Berkeley, California, which was a real thrill for me because some of my real heroes like Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary have had books published there, and so being acquired by them was a really wonderful thing. I am going to be appearing on Dr. Susan Block's web TV show on Saturday night, August 5th. 9:30 to midnight. Again, if people who are hearing this recording hear that in time, just Google Dr. Susan Block and you can see where this thing is broadcast and find out a little about her and their rather interesting program and culture around there. So, but yeah, it was a lot of fun and fascinating putting the book together, and I'm just trying to get out there and really sort of inform people about the fascinating spiritual culture of California, whether Christian or otherwise. And with the good Lord's will and the creek don't rise, there will be more books like this coming in the future.
Michael Marinacci, thank you for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Okay, thank you, Robert.
And also thanks, Pilliter and J.G. Michaels.
It's nice talking to you like always.
Yeah, I love this show.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.